Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
So this week we have Janice Selby, and she's going to talk us about how to break up with religion. So realizing it's over. So I'm just going to read her bio so that you can know a little bit more about her background. So Janice is a registered professional counselor with a personal history of religious trauma syndrome. She's passionate about helping others understand their losses and embrace their new identity in the secular world. Her own deconversion experience compelled her to develop the online Diverse in Religion workshop, a six-week interactive workshop combining written exercises and group work to bring together those from diverse backgrounds who are walking a similar journey. So Janice, welcome. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. And it's great to see so many people and even some folks that I know.
Isn't this cool?
It's very cool.
You never know who's going to show up, and to see those that number go up and up and up as people join the conversation, just so cool, exciting. So yeah, we've got well over 50 people here just to hear you talk.
Wow.
No pressure. Okay. So tell us a little bit, kind of like, how did you come up with this idea of breaking up with religion?
Divorcing religion. So I was raised in a fundamentalist Christian home. And then as I grew up and got married and had children, I married a fellow who became a pastor, and I became even much more fundamentalist than my parents ever were. Eventually I didn't. Eventually I started doubting, and I also was having trouble in my own marriage. And so I ended up divorcing religion and divorcing my husband. And I found that there were some parallels there because they were both very long-term relationships. I was married for 20 years, but I was religious for over 40 years, deeply devout. Wow. And so both were painful losses, and having to reorganize, restructure, rebuild myself and my life.
Yeah, that's something that's so common that we hear. And it's something that very similar to what I went through too, that what I experienced and how I felt coming out of religion too. What was the breaking point, the thing that sort of got you out of religion?
Right. Well, I talk about a seed of doubt that was planted. And as Christians, and I can only talk about in terms of being a Christian because that's what I was, we are taught really to fear doubt, to not allow doubt. You don't want to be a doubting Thomas, and doubt is from the devil. So when my first little seed of doubt crept in, I just tried to push it back into the dark recesses of my mind. But guess what? Seeds germinate in the dark. And my seed was, I started feeling resentful that I was expected to obey my husband all the time, no matter what. And I mean, he's a good guy. We actually have a great relationship, very close friendship. But does not always make the best decisions. And so to be in a position where I was told no matter what the choice was, he was my spiritual head given to me by God, ordained by God, to steer the ship that was our family, right? He just steered that mother onto the rocks sometimes. Things were terrible. And sometimes I knew that I was capable of making a better decision, and I just really resented that I couldn't, simply by virtue of the fact that I didn't have the right physical equipment, right? Mm-hmm. So that was kind of like the first chink in my armor, the first hole that where I started going, oh, I don't know about this. But the one that really in the end made me walk away from all religion was when our youngest daughter was diagnosed with a life-threatening illness. And I felt like I had devoted my entire life to serving God and serving Jesus. I tried so hard to be holy and to really be worthy of being known as a follower of Christ. We didn't have TV, we didn't have radio, I wore a head covering, no jewelry, no makeup, just long skirts and dresses all the time, homeschooled our daughters. And so when my little one was diagnosed, it really just shook me to my core. And I was thinking, what is going on here? And so, of course, people in my circle are wondering, well, is there sin in your life? Is God chastening you? What's why? There's a reason. It's happening for a reason. You must have done something wrong and God's trying to get your attention, which all was just baloney. And the thought that a loving God could afflict a child, an innocent child, with a life-threatening disease just didn't sit right with me. So that was the one that in the end made me just turn my back on it all. But it wasn't immediate. I had to go through a process. Like, it took all my courage to go across the street to this little bookstore that we have in my town and go into the back section where they had occult and metaphysical books. Like, I had walked by that section before and I never would have dared to go in there. But I started thinking, there's got to be something else. I've missed out on something. I've been on the wrong horse. I have to figure out, somebody must be right and it's not the Christians. So eventually I plucked up all my courage and went back in there and thought I'd get struck with lightning, but I did not. And found a book that was kind of a textbook about different religions, so Christianity and Islam and Buddhism. And I bought that book. I went up to the counter. I had the clerk put it in a brown paper bag because I didn't want anyone to see it. And then I took it home. I ran home and I put that book in the safest place I knew, where even God would not look, in my underwear drawer, safe from any prying eyes. And it stayed there for a while. And eventually I took it out and started reading it bit by bit. And but I couldn't tell my husband I had it. Like, I remember being in the basement one time with it, and I could hear him coming down the stairs. And so I quickly was putting this book somewhere, but that he couldn't see it. And we were all struggling because of the diagnosis and how scary everything was at that time. But I didn't feel that I could talk to my husband and say, I'm questioning God, or I'm doubting religion, because our marriage also was coming apart at that time. So we just had a lot on our plates, a lot we were trying to deal with. But eventually I went back to the bookstore and I kind of went from Christianity, went into the whole New Age deal, grew dreadlocks, you know, got books about crystals, got tattoos with lotus flowers, and, you know, all that woo-woo kind of stuff. Went there for a while until I eventually got to a point where I didn't feel that I needed that either. But it took years for me even to be comfortable enough to say that I was not a Christian. That was a big deal to get to that point.
So so it sounds like you've got a really pretty good background in, or a good story that almost, did it kind of help push you to create this divorcing from religion concept and idea? Because it sounds like a lot of it is integrated into what you talk about.
Absolutely, because I didn't know anybody else who had gone through a similar experience. I didn't know anyone else who had been as devout as I knew I was, or for as long as I was, because it was my whole life pretty much. And who then decided to walk away from it. So my siblings had walked away from their faith in their teens. And I think they were very surprised that I hung on. But one reason that I hung on was because I saw the tremendous pain that it caused my parents emotionally when each sibling walked away. And I'm the youngest one, and I felt like it was partly my responsibility to be an extra good daughter to try and make up for the yahoos, my older siblings. So I kind of lost a closeness with my older siblings because they weren't walking the same walk that I was. We still loved one another for sure. But now, since I have rejected religion, boy, we've become quite close. But so it was not knowing anybody else. I felt like I didn't have any real support. So I let my siblings know eventually what was going on, but they hadn't stayed in it as long as I had. They weren't married to a pastor. They hadn't dreamed of being a missionary and homeschooled kids and led Bible studies and done all those sorts of things. So, yeah, it was hard to find anyone. I didn't even know, I didn't have the words even to type into Google to ask, yeah, to try and find out. I didn't know words like deconstruct and deconversion and those kind of things. So it was just a very lonely, scary, and sad time. So that's one reason I developed the workshop, because I wanted other people to know there's hope. For one thing, there's hope at the end of all this, but also there are other people that you can connect with who can relate and who can support you. And Dr. Marlene Winnell was a really big influence for me, because it was when I first came across her teachings on the internet, or some interviews with her, and she wrote this book called Leaving the Fold, which is kind of a guide for people leaving fundamentalist groups and religions. And then there was a phone number I saw that I could phone her, and I phoned her, and she said, yeah, I do retreats, come to a retreat. And so that was my first experience meeting with other people. And I understand Recovering from Religion also has been, just before the virus started, started doing some retreats and giving people the opportunity to connect in person, in real life. There's nothing like it to meet with other people who can validate what you're going through and understand.
Yeah, that's a big part of what the support group side of RFR is, like really how Recovering from Religion was really founded on. Dr. Daryl Ray had this inkling of an idea and of meeting together face-to-face to kind of, well, he actually wanted to sell his book, but it turned out that it was actually a much bigger, much better thing. And the support groups are really, like what you had mentioned, powerful because of the in-person meetings and getting to see one another. Now, before we go too far, you had mentioned, and I'm a little concerned, worried about your daughters. Did everything turn out okay?
She is still alive, I'm happy to say. She really struggles with her health, so in the hospital fairly frequently. But there's not really too much we can do. So now my kids had a front row seat to my Gong Show deconversion. They watched me go from being like the super most uptight mom you can ever imagine to being like, whoa, we're getting tattoos, we're growing dreadlocks, we're smoking pot. So that was quite a change for them to witness. And really it was almost like I was going through an adolescence that I had never had. And that can be, that's one thing that I talk about in the workshop, just the importance of remembering that if you are a parent, if there's children in the home, they're watching you go through all these changes. So we want to be gentle and we want to be forthright and able to explain to kids, you know, to whatever age they are at. So they don't get worried and think that they're losing mom or dad, or dad's gone crazy, or mom's off her rocker, or whatever it is. But my kids, and so now they're both adults, and I talked about it with them, even in their late teens, and they said, Mom, you became a lot more fun when you stopped going. And my one kid said, yeah, you became a lot more like Jesus in some ways, like you stopped judging people. I thought you were great. So that was good.
Mm-hmm. All right. So where, I'm sorry, Maya, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say that I think it's so great that you also changed like your parenting style, because I can only imagine that after being in a religion for so many years, having to let go of it is already a challenge. Having to let go of your community is another challenge. And also learning how to be a parent, a secular parent, that must, all three of those things must have been so, so hard. So I have like so much like support for you, and like, I don't know, I admire you so much, because I can't imagine me ever being able to do that. Because parenting is already hard enough if you have to deal with all of those things.
Yes, and I was quite scared at first. I mean, I could handle the thought that if I was wrong, that if there was a hell and I was rejecting God, that I might go to hell. But it was very hard for me thinking, what if I'm wrong and so my kids follow me and they go to hell? And that was terribly burdensome, to the point where I would be weeping and just in tears, so upset and terrified. But it was interesting. So somewhere around there, middle to late teens, when it was obvious that I was deconverting and their father wasn't going to church, we weren't going to church anymore. And my one daughter said, well, you know, I started having doubts about it in Sunday school when they're talking about this guy gets all these animals on this boat. And I'm like, I did not doubt. I swallowed it all. I'm glad you were having doubts. But that was very interesting to me, because I had tried so hard to structure their lives so that they wouldn't doubt.
Yeah, got it. So where do we start with breaking up? It's hard to do with this discussion. Where's a good place to start? What's kind of the overall idea of it, and how do we get into it?
Well, I like people to think about how they met, how they in religion met. Because the idea is, you know, it's reflecting a marital divorce. Well, a marital divorce, it starts with actually when you meet the person. So I ask people, how did they meet religion? How were they introduced to it? Who introduced them to it? Because, and the poll, that's why we asked that in the poll about were your parents religious? Were they the ones, or your caregivers, are they the ones that introduced you to religion? Because as a child, we just lack that critical thinking capacity, and we're under tremendous pressure to please our caregivers. We're completely dependent on them. So when they say to us, this is the truth, this is how it is, we really don't have the ability or the choice to say, well, I disagree. I beg to differ on that one. So if you're introduced to something in childhood, it becomes a really tenacious belief. But if you're introduced to it in youth group or church camp, I mean, think of what it's like as a teenager. You're going through hormone storms and massive emotional swings, and the peer pressure is just incredible, the pressure to conform. So it's not surprising when kids go to youth group or go to church camp that they end up getting saved, making a salvation commitment or decision. But even for those of us who came to religion as adults, for the most part, I find people come to religion when they're in a state of flux. So maybe they've moved, or they've divorced, they've lost a partner, they've lost a job. Somehow their life is on uneven footing and they are looking for support. We want security, order, and certainty. That is what we all crave. And that is what religion promises, all wrapped up in a bow. So it's basically vulnerable people who end up, I feel like, getting sucked into religion.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, I remember the stuff that I was told, it really... like I thought that these magical things could really happen, like they were real, that these myths and legends could happen. I believed that in ghosts and angels and all that kind of stuff, but I didn't have any other example to look at or compare to. So it just had to be, couldn't be any other way. Cause just what I was told, it's all I knew. And I wasn't even really set up with a good sense of critical thinking skills either to kind of compare and evaluate. The world was way different through my eyes back then than it is now, for sure.
And if your life then revolves around the church, so if you're going to Sunday school and you're going to kids' church and you're going to choir and all these other things, and all the people basically that you know or are close to, they also all believe the same thing, then you're in that echo chamber. And it only makes sense to believe what you believe, because all these other people that you respect also believe it. But I mean, and your parents believe it, and you're still, well, they know more than me. They know how to pay taxes and do whatever. They must know about the afterlife too, so.
And how did you develop critical thinking skills? Because obviously if you have been brought up being told that having those skills is something that's sinful and that you have to suppress them, how did you develop them? Was it the books that you were reading, or how did you do it?
A hugely important thing when we're divorcing religion is for us to begin educating ourselves. And so, I mean, thankfully now we have the internet. Before, it was like you go to the library and get out the encyclopedia or whatever. But we have the ability to educate ourselves now, and that's a paramount importance. And so, yeah, I did just start reading books, watching videos. I love watching videos. There's a lot of good ones out there. Dr. Valerie Tirico also, I found her really encouraging and helpful, her videos. So just teaching ourselves. And then also when we're raising kids, to be trying to encourage them, incorporating critical thinking skills with them and conversations around the dinner table, and just asking them questions. If they make a statement, asking them gently and always encouragingly, what support do they have for that statement, or how could they find out more about it? So always with a feeling of encouragement rather than, that we're demanding this of them, because encouragement opens people up.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Do you have any tips for like people who are now maybe thinking, maybe they don't believe, but they don't want to let go of my community? How can these people either let go fully of religion, or how can they deal with it better, like psychologically or even like behavior wise?
Well, I would say definitely contacting your organization, because you have some excellent people to talk to on your phone lines when people may be just in that initial stage of exploring their doubt and coming to terms with their disbelief. And also it can be really helpful to join a Facebook group. There's tons of them on Facebook where other people have also come out of more fundamentalist mindsets. Mm-hmm. Now, some people leave it and immediately they become atheists. Now, that didn't happen to me. I told you a little bit of my journey where I was looking at this and looking at that instead. Now I am an atheist. Now I just don't believe. But everybody doesn't have to be at the same place at the same time. It's our individual journey, and we're allowed to ask questions. And so reach out to other people for support. Ask those questions, educate yourself, and it is possible to build communities outside of church. It's more challenging because church is the one-stop shop. Church is where you get your social needs met, your emotional needs met. You feel like you're being educated, even though it's like the same thing over and over again. So you have this sense of purpose. And now that we're out of religion, we have to take on the responsibility. We gave up a lot of responsibility when we were in religion. Now we're out of it. It's up to us to really grow ourselves up and start taking responsibility for the life that we want to be living. So if I have an interest in birds, maybe I'm going to join a bird watching group, and that's how I'm going to start meeting other people. If I am feel I'm lacking purpose, I'm going to start volunteering, because volunteering is a tremendous way for you to start feeling that you are giving, contributing back to the world. Explore humanism, join a humanist group. There's just, nothing has to be off limits. That's one thing I find. We have to get out and explore. We have to push some uncomfortable boundaries to see what's out there and see what we like and see who we are without religion.
So if I was just kind of had this seed of doubt implanted in me, and it actually started making me feel a little uncomfortable. Like I was beginning to doubt some things, but I continued to be told that it was still accurate, it was still right, it was still the truth. What would I do? What would you, if you and I met, what would you kind of tell me or talk to me or point me out or point to me as to like where to go and, or even encourage me to do? What would you kind of ask me to, or talk to me about?
Sure. I would really encourage you to continue educating yourself. And to do that, we need to look outside of what we've already been taught and move apart from the people who did the teaching. So looking into other teachings, you have to give yourself permission to do that, because it can feel so bad at first, because you've been taught to fear it. That's just the devil trying to lead you astray. But if we think about it, religion just basically doesn't want anybody thinking for themselves. They want you to keep towing the line and keep that religious machine moving. But as soon as you deviate from that, you start looking to educate yourself, you're starting to set yourself free. So educating yourself is really important.
What about this feeling that I've got? That I'm scared, I'm frightened, I feel alone. Are these kind of indications that I may be on the right track, or that I'm okay, or something? What do I do with these feelings?
I think feeling fearful is very normal when we're trying to break away from the only path that we've known. And particularly, fundamentalism is all about fear. That's how people are kept in line. Really, fear is the ultimate. Sometimes when we feel fear, it's actually an indication that we're doing something right, because we're going in the direction of our doubt. I want people to move in the direction of their doubt.
It almost sounds like you're talking about like two different types of feeling scared, because I recall in some sense being really afraid of hell or fear of retribution or something like that, but mm-hmm. Over time that feeling became more and more comfortable inside of me. Like it was like an old friend, or I knew that type of emotion. But starting to even question that kind of teaching, that kind of thinking, it was a different sense of fear, a different more uncomfortable and less familiar type of fear. Does that kind of make sense? Like one was a friend something I was used to. The other one was like something brand new.
And things that aren't familiar to us do feel uncomfortable. And that's one reason why it's so hard to change. We prefer feeling comfortable. Doing things that are foreign to us don't feel comfortable. So we do need to, and that's just a hard fact, sometimes we do have to embrace the fear, or that 1970s book, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. That's partly how we grow. And you're allowed to grow beyond your parents' expectations and the dreams that they had for you. You're allowed to grow beyond your childhood dreams, or even beyond what your spouse thinks you should be, who they think you should be. We're here to grow.
I like that. Sort of reframing it, instead of something to avoid pursuing, it could be something perceived as an opportunity, like the two sides of the same coin.
Yes, lovingly referred to as AFGO, another freaking growth opportunity. and it usually feels shitty. it's AFGO.
F stands for freaking.
Well, you know. We have some younger listeners, you never know. This is wine I'm drinking, by the way.
Awesome, I love it. I don't have anything to toast you with.
That's unfortunate. Another thing that I ask people is how long they were religious before the breakup came, because there can be a difference, you know, between someone who's been in a religion or a group for 2 years and someone who's been in it for 42 years. Like it can be a lot harder to extricate. I still find some of the ideas in my head are like chewing gum, just harder to pick out of my brain. So, okay, I'm researching evolution. I'm watching scientific shows about evolution. But still in the back of my head, sometimes it's like, yeah, but you know, that doesn't really make that much sense, because it's a much nicer thought that, oh, you're made in the image of this magnificent being. That's something that it's harder sometimes to get away from.
So, I guess, I was just saying that cognitive dissonance must be like a massive, massive thing in the process.
Absolutely. And it keeps people stuck in relationships and groups, not just religion. I mean, fundamentalism exists in many realms. We've got it in politics, in nutrition, in ecology. If you're rigid, if you're really rigid in your attachments, or if there's an authoritarian feel to it, you really need to examine that, because that is fundamentalist thinking. And I know many people who've been able to break free from religious fundamentalism, but they have not been able to break free from the fundamentalist mindset, and they can still be really difficult to be around because they still just have that air of authority and it's still my way or the highway. Super annoying.
Can you give us a quick definition of cognitive dissonance?
I can. It's the feeling of discomfort basically that we get when we're challenged with an idea that does not fit with our beliefs. So then we end up twisting ourselves into a mental pretzel, trying to protect our belief system. So, well, actually, the writer meant this. He didn't mean this other thing. Like, just trying to, we can't let those doubts in. We're going to cling really tightly to what we believe. And that's the cognitive dissonance. Even when we're presented with, I mean, I think of maybe someone who has been faithful in their marriage and they have always believed their partner to be faithful, and then they are presented with absolute fact that the partner is not faithful. It's so hard for them to get their mind and heart around that. They prefer just to think, no, it's not what it looks like. It can't, it's not what it looks like. And they'll make up excuses for it. And it can be similar when we're divorcing religion. A lot of cognitive dissonance there.
Yeah, it's applicable to so many different like environments, even in politics. If you're supporting like a specific party and a person from that party is not agreeing, well, he's saying something that makes absolutely no sense and you still support this person. So this is like a very, very common phenomenon, it's, like psychological phenomenon.
Yes, yeah, it's very normal, and all human beings engage in cognitive dissonance. It's just part of being human, but it's good to be aware of it and not to be afraid to explore when those other things come up, when those doubts come up. You know, follow it down that rabbit hole, see where it leads. Doubt is the seed from which knowledge sprouts.
Oh,
I love that sentence. Really nice.
I made it up.
I'm gonna put that up here next time. Yeah, I did experience some cognitive dissonance kind of going through that, going through my own journey out of religion. And it did take a while to kind of deal with them both. Like, it, there was these two conflicting ideas, and it took a while to kind of deal with them both and evaluate how one was better than the other. And it was kind of a painful process going through that. It was more than just religion too that I experienced. There was a book I read about how the commercial fishing industry is really destroying the ocean and the environment. And I like eating fish. I love eating shrimp, but I don't like the impact it had on the environment. And so I kind of eventually came to the conclusion, I don't want to eat fish anymore. I don't want to contribute to that anymore. But it was something I had to think over and hold those two conflicting things in my head for a while.
But you don't eat fish, Eric? I didn't know that about you.
No, I don't eat fish or shrimp. I would eventually like to kind of apply that to meat and stuff too, but I'm just not there quite yet.
Well, if you need any tips, let me know.
I know someone who is, though, huh, Amaya?
It has a lot to do with our level of attachment to different ideologies, because it's possible to hold an idea loosely. But then, because we're human, what we tend to do is go deeper and deeper and deeper, and our identity eventually becomes enmeshed with this ideology. And at that point, then it becomes very painful to try and separate the two. And this is where the cognitive dissonance comes in. So we want to make sure that we are holding beliefs, but the beliefs are not holding us. There has to be room for us to look at it from different sides and to drop it if new information comes to light, and that it won't completely destroy us, that we'll be able to say, oh yeah, you know what, I used to believe that, but actually I don't believe that anymore.
One of the things that if I was in that initial parts of doubting my religion, one of the things that it could would keep me in or I would use as a pro for staying on the religious and still continuing to believe would be like, well, I'm already so heavily invested in this community. I've got all my friends here. I've got all my family here. I've got so much time and effort I've put into building the church, so much money I've put towards the church. I kind of suspect, though, that that's not necessarily a valid thing to consider. It may be if for some people, but for me, it really, really wasn't. What are your thoughts on that?
That is also known as the sunk cost fallacy, where we invest so much time and energy and resources. So thinking of it in terms of a business model, you don't want to walk away and let your, you know, lose your business when you've already sunk all this money into it. For people who have invested decades of their life in the church, and they've, instead of getting a secular education, they've become a pastor, or they've given all their money to the church, or they've become a missionary in their whole life, all they've done is church related, to walk away from that is incredibly painful, jarring. It can feel humiliating if we have siblings or others who never bought into it to the degree that we did, and we're not met with compassion necessarily by them when they're just like, well, it's about time you saw through all that crap. When your heart is breaking, you're devastated, your entire worldview is dissolving. And so if you think of it, you know, like a skeleton holds you up or whatever, it's all dissolving. You've got nowhere to put anything anymore. Your whole frame of reference is gone. And that's there is such a deep and intense grieving that goes along with that, but society cannot relate. They don't understand the grieving that we're doing, and that compounds it and makes it much harder for us to heal and rebuild.
Oh, sorry, Eric.
That was exactly what I experienced. Exactly. And it sent me into a depression for 4 years. It took a lot of work and effort to climb out of it. But the whole worldview dissolved, my whole foundation crumbled.
Yes.
And it was painful, that for sure.
Absolutely.
Is there any organizations that help like economically recover from these sort of situations? So if someone has given all their money to the church, or even not economically, but in terms of like a life project, like developing a new life project. Because if before you were a missionary or your life plan was to have like a Christian family, is there any charities, organizations, or even websites, any resources that you know of that can help people in this area?
I don't know about financially helping people, but there are so many excellent websites and groups that do offer a lot of fantastic resources, like you folks at Recovering from Religion. I know Journey Free has quite a few. Dare to Doubt also is a group, an online website that has a lot of resources, even structured to different, you know, like if you're coming out of Islam here, you might want to read these will be helpful, or if you're coming out of Christianity, these ones might be helpful. You can't underestimate the power of meeting with other people and talking with other people who have walked that road and who understand it. And that's also why it's very important, if you're in a stage of deconversion, deconstruction, reconstruction from your religious beliefs, do not go to a spiritual counselor, a religious counselor at all. And even if you're going to a secular counselor, it's helpful to find one who also maybe knows the pain of leaving religion behind, because it's such multiple losses that we go through, multiple losses. It's not like you just stop believing in Santa Claus. That's so offensive when people say that. They don't have any idea what it's like when you've built your entire life on this belief system and given everything you had, and then it's gone. So
here in the US, we have an organization called the Clergy Project that helps folks whose livelihood was dependent on believing in the tenets, kind of coming out of it, some therapy, and even as far as changing your name too. So I'm not sure if they help financially, but I know that they do help with even training with some other skill sets. Because
what a wonderful organization! That's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I in some sense, being trained to be a pastor or a preacher, there aren't necessarily a lot of skills that can transfer over into the real world. Maybe public speaking, maybe writing.
Sales.
Okay. All right. Well, I take it back then. Yes. Be an excellent salesman. So when I was, when this whole worldview dissolved for me, not only was it like scary, but I was like super confused. There felt like a sense of shock. It was a gradual thing, but there was this one snap, this one thing where it broke, and it was, I went through so many different emotions. And from what I hear, that's pretty darn common.
Yeah, absolutely. There, and you're just like with the grief of losing a person to death, there can be stages of grief, there's different feelings, and you're bouncing back and forth. You might be one day, or you absolutely understand and embrace that this is not true, and then the next day you're running back trying hard to shore up that belief again. Or anger is very common, especially for people who've spent a lot of years and a lot of money, a lot of time in the church. They feel angry and ripped off. And then there can also be, for some people, a great sense of relief that they don't have to pretend to be perfect anymore. They're allowed to live life as they please, because there are no life police. So there are lots of different feelings and emotions that go along with it, and it's okay. It's all part of the journey.
And in terms of relationships, because I know you said before that you started feeling resentment against your husband, And I can only imagine that people go through that, maybe not only with their husbands or partners, but also with like friends or community leaders. So how do you think these people can deal with those emotions of like negative emotions against the people that they love? Because that must be also really, really challenging.
Well, you know, a big challenge in divorcing religion is when we have loved ones that remain in that belief system and they remain quite entrenched in it. And what we need to remember is that they are terrified on our behalf. Like our parents, their one objective was to keep us safe at all costs. And now they think we're absolutely in peril of eternal damnation because we're not believing the same anymore. So if we can remember that, it allows us to keep some compassion for them, and also seeing that they're not, it's like they've got blinders on. They think they're seeing everything, but they're really not. And you can't actually make them see. People have to get there on their own. And your relationships do change. A lot of relationships then become out of necessity more shallow. Because if all you're going to do is fight over these religious things, it's easier. At some point, you have to conserve your energy and decide, I'm not going to keep fighting with you about this. But what do we still have in common? We still love one another. We still love our children. We still want to make the world a better place. What can we do for volunteering? Can we clean up our city? Can we give out masks? What can we do? You're looking at things that you still have in common instead of focusing on the thing that you don't have in common anymore.
And how do you know the line between you have to let go of this person because he's too toxic for you, or it's just too hurtful, or when do you think you can keep this relationship with this person even if you hold different beliefs? So where do you think is the line that people should like kind of cross or not cross?
I think it's going to be very individual based on personal circumstance and what the relationship is like. Certainly, I would say if you feel that you're in danger at all, or your children are in danger, then that's, you know, you need to be working on a safety plan potentially for exiting, because that's the most dangerous time for women, is when they have told their partner that they want a divorce. So you need to be careful and thoughtful and pragmatic when you're taking big steps like that. And as far as cutting other people out of your life, I recently had to cut my father out of my life, and he's 85. He just turned 85, but he is so overbearing and refuses to accept my boundaries or honor my boundaries. And I think that's probably the key. If someone is constantly stepping over your boundaries and disrespecting you, you need to take a hard look at that. What is the purpose for keeping them in your life, and what is the cost of having them there? Is it worth it? You're allowed to outgrow somebody.
Yeah, I like that. And there was a part of my religious upbringing was being fed this idea that parents are always going to love their kids. They're always going to be there for you. That's always going to be there for the kids. It's always going to be like the priority is the kids, the children. And that was the fantasy that I kind of grew up with and was believed. So it kind of kept me coming back to an emotionally abusive father, trying to rebuild the life, the relationship with him. Even though I knew that he would consistently break that trust and I would walk away hurt again. There was a time that I suddenly just had enough, and it was really painful for me. But I asked myself, there was a time where I saw through that fantasy where I'm like, look, I didn't choose this guy. Maybe this whole idea of a perfect family or father and mother need to will and need to love their children, maybe this isn't all real. And so I kind of asked myself, if I met this guy in a bar, sat down next to him, we started chatting, would we be friends afterwards? Would we want to see one another afterwards? Would we hang out? And the answer was no. And so I haven't really talked to him since. And it hurts every now and then, but it's gotten a lot duller over the years. But
what an excellent exercise. That is a really good thing to think about. I tell people, I just remind them, so our parents are in our lives, you know, until we reach the age of majority, we generally don't really have too much choice. After they've raised us, they've completed that task. Your parent is in your life by invitation only. There is no law that says you must maintain contact and regular interaction with your parent. It just, there is no law for that. So you must choose your own health, make the decision for your own health, especially if they're narcissistic, if they're toxic in some way. Givers have to set limits because takers rarely do. You are in charge of your life from this point on. You're an adult. You get to make the choice who is going to be in your life and who's not.
I gotta tell you that first understanding and realizing that is super frightening. But over time, on the other side, it's become very, very freeing too. Just to be responsible for one's own life coming out of high school and not really knowing much else about the world other than whatever clicks and books.
And again, it comes back to us learning to take responsibility for ourselves, because we didn't. When we were in church, we always deferred to God or to pastor or to husband. And if something went wrong, you know, the devil did it, rather than, geez, I made a really poor choice there. So it's learning to take responsibility. And I've heard it said, just as we have the Statue of Liberty on the East Coast, we should have the Statue of Responsibility on the West Coast to balance it out. And that's a balance that we need to find as we go along.
And how can we deal with the feeling of guilt? So I guess that's also a very common feeling, apart from anger, sadness, shock, confusion. Guilt not only about leaving religion, but also about maybe if you have been a missionary, about having converted other people. How can we deal with this sort of feeling?
I think when it comes to things like we've witnessed to other people, or maybe you've been a pastor and you baptized people and now you're going, wow, it was something that was false and I converted all these people. There's a point where you really have to practice radical self-acceptance and forgiveness of yourself. At the time, you thought you were doing what was best. You really thought you were doing what was best for those people and for yourself. Now you know differently. Now you're going to do differently. Guilt can be so crushing. Mm-hmm. Really, I just urge people to examine what's the real reason for the guilt. And if you've been raised in fundamentalism, you know all about guilt because it's been heaped on you. But you need to be able to take a hard look at what you're feeling guilty about and why, and write it out and talk to somebody else about it. And I think it takes time, but eventually we can get past that feeling. Mm-hmm.
I do like that that inner observation of I kind of look at people, if they're doing something weird or something that I don't like, I kind of give them a few chances, thinking to myself that they are doing the best they can with the information that they have at the time. But very often, I just don't apply that to myself. And I need to start applying that to myself, to some of the mistakes I made in the past. I did the best I could, for the most part, with the information I had at the time.
Yeah, self-compassion. We could all use more of it. I think most of us are pretty darn hard on ourselves. We're willing often to make allowances for other people, but we're not so willing to make allowances for ourselves. And you have to just cut yourself some slack.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our friends and I have like this saying that you can only talk to yourself as if we were talking to each other. So you can never tell yourself something that you couldn't tell your friend, if that makes sense.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Because sometimes we talk to each other in such a negative way that you would never dare to talk to any of your friends like that, because it's just not respectful and it's not healthy. So it's to kind of have that mindset.
That's right. And that goes back to a question you asked a little bit earlier about how does somebody know whether they should stay or they should go? Sometimes we can encourage them, what would you tell your best friend? Or what would you tell your daughter or your son if they were exactly in this situation that you are in? Would you want them to stay? Would you encourage them to stay? Or would you say, you know, you need to go for your own health. You need to go. So yeah, that's a very good way of looking at it. Thanks for that reminder.
Yeah, I like that. So what else did we miss talking about this? What else do you think we should discuss or continue talking about on this topic?
Well, one other thing that I ask people is what kept them hanging on? Mm-hmm. What kept them hanging on? If they, you know, how long, if they made the choice, they came to the realization that it wasn't true, did they keep going to services? How long did they keep going? And why did they keep going? I think for a lot of people, it's the community aspect, because it's pretty hard to give that up when that's been your whole life. And of course, if we're married to someone who's still very much a believer, that's a really hard one. But something people need to examine. I held on in my marriage absolutely as long as I could. And I tried to convince myself that it was all just me and I just had to change. And if I would just do this differently or that differently. So I tried for many years to be different, to be someone other than who I am. And eventually I realized, no, there's two people involved in this. And it's not enough just if I'm willing to do the work. And there's no prize for being a martyr. This is the life that you get. So you, if you got to please one person, you better make it yourself. You're responsible for your own happiness. And people have different levels of things that are acceptable for them. What's acceptable for me might not be acceptable for you. So it's very individual, but it's all opportunities for reflection and self-growth, AFGO.
That's freaking great. Yeah. Oh man, it slipped my mind what I was going to say. Am I got anything else?
Not that I can think of. Is there anything you would like to add before we go to the Q&A, Janice?
Maybe just give your friends here some thoughtful words to think about. So we were talking about today was the first module in my 6-module Divorcing Religion workshop. It's an online workshop. And at the end of each module, I like to give you some thoughtful words. So the first one, the first phrase I chose is, divorce is like death without a burial. So it's that hard. When you are divorcing religion, when you lose your faith, it can be as difficult as losing a loved one.
Yeah, that's something that rings really kind of true with me. My mother went through a very difficult divorce with my father, and I hate to say it, but it was hard on myself too. But there was a time where she said, I almost wish that it would have been better, like her experience would have been better if he had died, like because my father was still around there as a reminder and as a constant irritant, and it wasn't a like clean departure suddenly everything was good and gone. No, but there was still this old past stuff that had to be dealt with, and every time she would see him, it'd be a constant reminder of what she went through and the sadness and the sorrow. So it was worse than having him die. It was very, very tough and traumatic. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it hits us on that deep of a level. It hits us right to our core, this tremendous loss. I like this next phrase by Daphne Rose Kingma. She said, holding on is believing there is a past. Letting go is knowing there is a future. And I really like that. Letting go is knowing there is a future. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It takes courage to let go.
Yeah,
Yeah, I can relate that too to the story I related about walking away from my father. There was a freedom to that because I had made that choice and I was no longer bound by the fantasy I had of like, I keep having to go back to him and knowing I would get hurt again. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. And so much of relationship really is fantasy. I mean, thinking particularly of that, when we think of our mother and our father and the relationship that we feel like we're supposed to have with them, but that is besides the point. That's not real a lot of the time. You know, maybe mom was 17 years old and got pregnant and wasn't planning on, you know, this wasn't the fantasy that she had. And so she's bringing to it what she can, but it's not going to match up to that Brady Bunch kind of ideal where everybody's so perfect and happy. Some parents are really unhealthy. Some parents are addicted to harsh substances or harsh behaviors, and they don't know how to parent. And so then you have to step up and parent yourself and reparent yourself as an adult. And they're not going to give you what you need. So you're going to have to find a way to give it to yourself. That's very true.
Yeah, the same thing would apply to folks in religion too. Or no, the folks in the leaders in religion as well. They're not necessarily going to give you what's true.
And they're, a lot of times, pastors are narcissists. I mean, not all pastors, but a lot of pastors are really drawn to the limelight and can be very authoritarian. And finding out that they are just real people can be painful, but it can break the spell.
Yeah, the power is pretty addictive mm-hmm.
for some folks. Yeah. I like this one too. Don't ignore pain. Appreciate its message. You need to change now. That's the message that pain is giving us. Something needs to change. Something's in trouble. Don't just ignore it. Don't just think it's going to go away.
Okay. That's good too.
And not only for religion, I think for literally any situation in your life that is giving you constant pain, it's just a good reminder of if it's been so bad, just let go of it, even if you're holding on to it.
That's right. There's no prize for being a martyr. You need to figure your shit out. That's my quote. I like this one. The first revolution.
That'll go up here too, is you got to figure your shit out.
That's right. This one is by Gil Scott Heron, and Gil said, the first revolution is when you change your mind. And I love that, because that, in order for you to enact change, you first have to change your mind. That you have to flip that switch. And once you've done that, you can start really making some changes. And then the last phrase I have, I hope that you'll all really take it to heart when you're having a hard time. You're a diamond, dear. They can't break you. And I'm saying that to each and every one of you. You're a diamond. They can't break you.
Oh,
that's beautiful.
Well, Janice, thank you. Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. I really, really enjoyed this.
I had fun. Thank you.
Yeah, we've got a Q&A. There's a lot of questions that folks have asked in the chat. We've got some resources that Janice has assembled. I'll go ahead and make sure that gets put in the chat. Then we'll also put some links in there to reach out to Janice afterwards and see kind of what she's doing and what she's up to. So Amaya, you want to take some of the first questions?
Sure. So the first question that we have is, I am an agnostic at this point, although I want to fully give up my disbelief in God, since the idea is pretty illogical. I still cling to it out of fear of hellfire. My question to you all is, how does one get over the fear of hell? I know overcoming it is different for different people, but although I'm agnostic, I'm having a hard time getting over my fear of hell or God's judgment after reading the Bible.
Some people find it really helpful to do some research on the idea of hell and where it originated, kind of when it started first popping up into literature in history, and even how it changed over time, and certainly to think about the benefit that the church has in making you continue believing that there's a hell. That is the greatest element of control, the greatest way to control people, is to tell them that you know exactly what's happening in the afterlife, and they're really going to suck at it. They're going to be eternally damned. So do some reading, watch some videos on the idea of hell and where it came from. Mm-hmm.
I believe we do have a few resources in our resource page in RFR regarding fear of hell. So feel free to also check them out, because they'll hopefully will help you. And in relation to this question, someone else has asked like a similar one. So it says, I am terrified of the idea of the devil, witches, and malign spirits. I'm from Latin America, and this is a very sensitive subject to me. I am trying to get closer to God on my own understanding. But because I'm in a 12-step program now, but it terrifies me because I don't know how to unlearn everything about it. I'm not even capable of saying the word devil out loud because I'm afraid that saying it is going to like hurt me, will invoke it.
Wow, I really have a lot of compassion for the person who wrote that question. I think they had a lot of courage to even put that out there. If you're struggling so much that you can't even say the word devil out loud, you are truly suffering with those thoughts. I'm sorry for you.
Yeah, it must be so difficult having all of these negative ideas of like negative spirits or the devil and things like that. I can't imagine how that must affect your life on a daily basis.
Yes, and being steeped in a culture where that is considered a very natural, very normal part of the culture. Everybody believes in this and potentially adds their own twist to it, or their own weight to it. That just can make it even harder for people to come to terms with it. And also 12-step programs, very much focused also on the idea of a God.
Yeah.
Would you have a similar advice of just going out there and kind of educating yourself on devils and witches and what would make them real and what wouldn't make them real?
Yep, I really think that's the way to go, and making a list. I love lists. I love writing things down because it allows me to compare and contrast. But videos, books, essays that people have compiled on these thoughts, because you need to set yourself free from that. That is too great of a burden for you to be carrying around.
Yeah. So. One of the things that I talked about and I experienced when I lost that last bit of spiritual thinking was, I went through a really deep depression, and it was for a very long time. Is there a name for that, or is it a part of something larger, perhaps? Do you know?
You mean the depression that you went through specifically related to that?
Yeah.
I think it's part of the grief process, part of the grieving process. And there are different types of grief. Like, we tend to just think of grief in one big lump or one big thing, but there are different aspects to it.
Yeah. Now, you were instrumental in setting up a conference out in Vancouver, or out in the British Columbia, about religious trauma. Is that right?
Yes, we had to postpone it because the virus was coming right at the time that we were going to have it. So we're moving it to an online format. We're working behind the scenes right now to get that all together.
So that kind of focuses around religious trauma syndrome, or some folks just write it out as RTS. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that and talk to us about maybe what are some of the symptoms are and what the healing goes into dealing with it?
Sure. I already mentioned Dr. Marlene Winnell. She's a psychologist in the United States and has written that book, Leaving the Fold. And Marlene is the one that actually coined the phrase religious trauma syndrome. And she talks about it in terms of it being a set of symptoms or characteristics that a person can have as a result of being in a very rigid religious system. So there are things that we are forced to give up to be in that system. And then when we leave, there are things again that we have to leave, things that are stripped away from us. So it's kind of a double whammy where you're traumatized by being in the group in the first place, and then you're traumatized by leaving the group. So when I think about RTS, that's the way that I'm picturing it. And so there's a lot of crossover with complex PTSD, religious trauma syndrome. So a person may have physiological effects. You may have trouble sleeping. You may have digestive issues. You can have like heart palpitation, things related to anxiety. And then of course there's the depression that can come along, that we've talked about that as well. And then there are things like your whole way of thinking has been impacted, the whole way that you view the world, your perspective. So if our perspective are like glasses that we put on that color how we see everything. And so you kind of have to relearn when you leave religion. Everything is different than you were taught that it was. So it's very shocking and jarring as well.
Yeah,
I would like to remind everyone that like there are therapists, if you can afford to, obviously there are therapists who specialize in this kind of issues. So if you would like to like contact any of them, I think it's a great idea if you can afford it, because they will be able to give you a much more personalized like therapy or tips or coping skills than maybe obviously a religious leader could, or like a different therapist could. So feel free to look for specifically that kind of issue if you do want to deal with it specifically. Because I'm seeing a lot of people in the comments who believe that they're probably struggling with it. So it's a great resource to use if you need to.
Excellent point. And if you are already in therapy with a secular therapist, but they're not familiar with it or they don't have a religious background, you can certainly recommend to them or ask them to do some reading on religious trauma syndrome, because that will help them become familiar with whatever is going on with you. It might give them a much greater insight, which can help in your therapy.
Awesome. Janice, thank you so, so much for joining us today.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.